The Tom Woods Show, episode 2079.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, a lot of your friends believe that deregulation caused the financial crisis of 2008 just as fervently as they believe that lockdowns are the solution to COVID-19. For the sake of our future, both of these ideas need to be smashed, so check out my free ebook, The Deregulation Boogeyman, over at regulationmyths.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I have just returned from Williamsport, Pennsylvania, where I spoke at the state convention of the Libertarian Party of Pennsylvania. And I am happy to report that the results there were very good. Now, I know that a great many of you may not have any interest whatsoever in the Libertarian Party. I totally understand that. But even if you don't, well, there's got to be at least a little part of you that feels like the world would be a better place if we had one more institution that consistently took a sound approach to the COVID hysteria, which, although a great many of the restrictions are falling away, is not yet over and could still return in one form or another. And of course, I think it's very important that we do everything possible to ensure that this can never happen again. So it remains important to be sound on this issue. So regardless of whether you're interested in politics or the LP in particular, I'm sure you'll agree with me, it would be better if spokesmen for that institution were clear and unequivocal on issues of importance like this, and not just the issue of the virus and the state response, but a lot of issues where the Libertarian Party, if it's going to really be true to libertarian ideas, has to say unpopular things, has to say things that, yes, I know, are going to make us unpopular with the New York Times, are going to make us unpopular with Anderson Cooper. I understand that. I know you're right. You know, those of you who, not among my listeners, of course, who make this complaint that, well, if you say such and such, then people aren't going to like us. Well, the legacy media isn't going to like us. I'll grant you that. But there are a lot of people out there who are politically homeless who could bear to hear some bold messaging. So anyway, I want to see the Libertarian Party, if it's going to have the word libertarian in it, at least not be a grotesque embarrassment to the cause and philosophy of libertarianism. So anyway, I was in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Now that right away tells you something about the way the Libertarian Party of Pennsylvania was being run. Why would you choose a place that is extremely inconvenient for everyone to get to? It's not close to anything. I had to take two flights and then drive an hour and a half to get there. And I heard from some people, I can't prove this, of course, but I heard from some people that this was actually a deliberate attempt to try to prevent people from attending. Because last year, the Mises Caucus of the Libertarian Party, which Ron Paul refers to as the libertarian wing of the Libertarian Party, the people who think the party ought to be something more than a social club, ought to be more than just an outlet for people who never really got to do much in their lives to be able to say, well, I'm the state chair of so-and-so, and I'm the treasurer of such-and-such, that it ought to be more than just that, or that it ought to do more than just repeat whatever the latest left-wing craze is. I think just simply jumping on whatever the latest left-wing bandwagon is so as not to appear out of the mainstream is also not really what the Libertarian Party ought to be doing. It ought to follow the example of its own predecessors, people like Harry Brown, who just in season and out were giving the unvarnished truth to the American public. Well, anyway, last year, the Mises Caucus gave them a real scare that maybe the party might actually turn into an outlet of libertarianism, if you can believe that. So, of course, we were called every name in the book, right? We're fascists, Nazis, racists, bigots, this phobe, that phobe. In other words, exactly the same kinds of things that any leftist would call us. Any leftist would call you those names. Nobody in his right mind uses language like that. And yet, here we have it coming out of the libertarian movement. So what the Mises Caucus wants to do is to try to place the emphasis on really, really important issues where the Libertarian Party is saying something that nobody else is saying. The point of the Mises Caucus is to orient the party toward those issues that are truly central to what libertarianism is all about. So anti-war and anti-propaganda, it's obvious what our position on lockdowns would be. But beyond that, central banking and money. Now, I realize, again, for somebody who craves New York Times approval, well, that's not a fashionable issue to talk about at all, right? We can't talk about the Federal Reserve. Why, only conspiracy-minded cranks talk about that. No, we need to talk about, you know, insert seven completely safe and tame issues into this quotation. I mean, it's not very inspiring, let's just say, the bland kind of messaging that people like this want to put out. It's certainly not going to make anybody think, I really, really urgently need to join this party and be part of this movement. Yeah, they might cast the occasional vote here and there, but in terms of really firing them up to get out there and do work, milquetoast messaging just doesn't do anything. And of course, a key element of marketing is product differentiation. It's not that we're kind of like the Democrats, but we're also kind of like the Republicans. And so we have some liberalism and some concern. No, that is not it at all. It's not like we're just weirdly eclectic people who kind of like a little bit of this and a little bit of that. No, we have a philosophy. We have an extremely consistent philosophy. We have a set of principles and we just apply them to every single situation and out pops the result as to what we believe. We're not just drawing a little bit from, we're not fiscally conservative and socially liberal. What an embarrassing way to describe what we are. Like fiscally conservative, that never means anything. People who say they're fiscally conservative, that never really means anything. There are a handful of people who actually wind up being fiscally conservative. But usually that's just a fundraising trick to trick the rubes into donating to these people. And then they go around and set records for debt and spending anyway. So I don't want to use a phrase like that. Why would I want to use that phrase? I don't want to use these weird establishment phrases that the existing parties already use. Why would I want to do that? So anyway, the point is, it was a clean sweep at the convention in terms of delegates going to the national convention in Reno in May. Virtually all of them are in our corner. And then in terms of the people who will now be running the Libertarian Party of Pennsylvania. Now we have serious people who believe fully in libertarianism, including the unpopular things that sometimes you need to say. So Dave Smith and I, virtually all people listening to this program know who Dave Smith is, host of Part of the Problem, stand-up comedian, great, great guy, outstanding libertarian communicator. He and I were to sort of rile up the troops and get them ready for what was going to happen over the weekend. So he and I did that. And I just wanted to take this episode to reiterate some of the things I said at that event. I was very, very pleased with how this went. Now, one thing I didn't say in my formal remarks, such as they were, but that I did say later in the Q&A period, is something I want to repeat right now. And it's directed at the most deranged among our critics. Honestly, we're not talking about that many people. We're really not. It's a very small sliver. They're loud, but it's a very small sliver of the libertarian world. It's the sliver that doesn't like Ron Paul. Okay, so they could, if we still had phone booths, they could hold their convention in there. This is the group of people that we're dealing with. And these are the sorts of people who will say that people like me, now you guys who have listened to me for years and years and years, will find this astonishing. But they'll call people like me fascists, fascist, a fascist who believes in non-aggression, a fascist, a racist, a this, that, and the other thing. What's funny is that the people who listen to me the most are the ones who say, look, I've listened to 2,000 episodes from this guy. I don't know what it is that you're detecting here that I'm not, but I've listened to 2,000 episodes. Number of episodes these people listen to is zero. It's always zero. I don't know where they're getting this stuff from, or they're just repeating what they heard other people say, or whatever it is, but they use these left-wing, career-destroying smears to try to attack people like Dave Smith, me, Michael Malice, Maj Toure, Eric July, Jeff Deist. In other words, all the most popular people we have. All the most popular people we have are the ones they attack. So the point that I made in the Q&A, one of the points I made in the Q&A, is that if that's really the case, that libertarians are so incapable of distinguishing between fascism and libertarianism that they all accidentally flock to Dave and me and all these other people, then the movement is hopeless. You might as well just give up. If it's that bad, if the alleged fascists happen to also be the ones with by far the most influence and by far the largest audiences, then the movement is hopeless. at my 2000th episode event live in Orlando late last year, I had five times as many people there as there were at the Libertarian National Convention. So if I am all the things these people are pretending I am, and yet I garner that much response from libertarians, then the movement is hopeless, and you might as well give up. Or I even pointed out, I know this is tooting my own horn, but so what? 2019, in Vienna, I was awarded the Hayek Lifetime Achievement Award. Peter Thiel also won this award a couple of years before me. Now again, if somebody like me, who is alleged to be all these terrible things, wins a Lifetime Achievement Award in Europe for service to the cause, then the movement is hopeless. You might as well just give up. Or maybe Dave and Eric and all these others and I are actually not those things that they're accusing us of being. I would say that is by far the more likely explanation. So the gist of what I said kind of came right down to this. I had lunch the day I left for Pennsylvania because I had a later flight. So I still had time to have lunch at home at a restaurant with a guy named Anthony Welty, whom I've had on the Tom Woods Show a couple times. I'd never met him in person. He was passing through the area, so we decided to have lunch. And at one point in the lunch, he asked me why I do what I do. I mean, I have produced over 2,000 podcast episodes. I have nothing left to prove to anybody. It's pretty clear to people I can produce a lot of podcast episodes, okay? That is beyond dispute. I can crank out a lot of content. But by now, there are a lot of things I could go do. And yet here I am still doing this. Why am I doing this? Why am I drawn to this? And I said, you know, my answer is going to seem unbelievably naive and simple, but it is the honest to goodness truth. I find the ideas that we talk about on this show that we believe in to be beautiful. I think they're beautiful ideas. And I think the moral vision contained in these ideas is beautiful. What are we saying? We're saying that human beings, without coercion, without somebody barking out orders through a proverbial bullhorn, can interact with and cooperate with each other to generate a prosperous world and a peaceful world and an orderly world. And that's an extraordinary vision that we, by virtue of each of us pursuing what is best for us, can generate such a happy and amazing result. There's something incredible about that vision. Now, we could be wrong about this. It's possible that maybe there's a better society that other people could create with other principles. It's possible that maybe if our principles were consistently adhered to, the results would actually be terrible. I don't think that's the case. But I mention that because usually when you try to describe libertarian ideas to skeptics, it seems to me the response you get should be, the vision you have of mankind is very compelling and even beautiful. I just don't think in practice it's going to work out the way you want it to, but your vision is very attractive. We don't even get that. It's just immediate condemnation. Like there's not even an attempt to reckon with the ideas or to use your imagination for 5 minutes, or it's just immediately, oh, well, then who would build the roads? Like you can't use your imagination for 5 minutes and come up with a way we could build roads that doesn't involve clocking people over the head to coerce them into doing it. There's no way, you honestly can't think of any way that that could be done. And so it is an endless source of astonishment to me that more people don't find libertarian ideas instantly compelling to the point where they feel overwhelmingly a desire to assent to them. And so I want to do what I can to make this appeal and to spread these ideas and to explain them and to make them easier to understand and make people more ready to adopt them. I mean, what are we basically saying? It really is, to quote the title of that Matt Kibbe book, don't hurt people and don't take their stuff. That's basically it. Now, that's not all you need to do to be a good person. And sometimes I get libertarians who kind of imply that, that as long as they abide by the non-aggression principle, they're good. No. That's the bare minimum to be a good person, I would say. At the end of your life, do you really want to say your greatest accomplishment was that you didn't beat anybody to a pulp? I mean, that's honestly as much as you want to have said for you. I mean, of course, there's vastly more that you want to do to be a good person. But the minimal requirements, I mean, the absolute rock bottom that you have to adhere to is don't hurt people and don't take their stuff. So we're not asking an inordinate amount from people. We're not making wild demands of the public. It's more or less those two things. But what follows from those two things is the tricky thing. Because when you examine those principles in depth, you realize what that means. What does that mean for taxation? What does that mean for antitrust regulation? Just to pick an example at random. What does that mean for agriculture policy? What does that mean for the drug war? What does that mean for this, that, and the other thing? And when you implement don't hurt people and don't take their stuff, when you implement it and you extend it to all these issues, yeah, some people won't feel like they can follow you quite that far. Yeah, they in the abstract, that does sound good. Yeah, I believe in that. Don't hurt people and don't take their stuff. But on the other hand, we do need to clock people over the head if they do X, Y, or Z. The principles are simple, but sometimes the application is difficult. And so when you have over 2,000 podcast episodes, you get to a lot of those objections. So that's why I do what I do. I love the ideas. I'm a puzzle solver also. I mean, I was the captain of the math team in high school. Okay, which was, by the way, young men, not the path to popularity. Okay, probably knew that. But later in life, you'll be glad you did that. Okay, because now, yeah, now everybody wants old Woods' help with math. Look who's come crawling back now. I get all kinds of people who need math help, not least of among them are my own daughters. But it is nice to have this kind of knowledge. But I'm a puzzle solver. That's what I loved about math. I loved how elegant it was, how beautiful it was. I know you math haters out there can't believe somebody would use adjectives like that to describe math, but that is how I feel about it. It's beautiful and elegant. And there are a lot of times where I think about libertarian principles and I think about particular situations and I think, well, how would we solve that problem non-coercively? And so it becomes like a puzzle, and I love solving puzzles. And it's true, there are times where even though the basic principles that we believe in are very simple to grasp, there are times when the things we're saying can appear counterintuitive. For example, we're against a centrally planned economy, as indeed at this point most people now are. We're against a centrally planned economy. Now, the thing is, if you didn't have the example of the Soviet Union in front of your face as an example of a failed centrally planned economy, couldn't you imagine yourself at least thinking that it seems on the surface to be plausible that a coordinated economy planned by a committee would be more efficient than an economy in which there's a, quote, anarchy of production, where everybody just does whatever he wants? Doesn't that sound like that would be chaotic, right? And you'd get much more order and efficiency if you had a bunch of people, quote, unquote, in charge. At least intuitively, can't you understand why some people at least would think that way and why you yourself might think that way? If you didn't have historical examples of this failing, doesn't it sound like a reasonable position? And doesn't it sound like people who would question that are just asking for chaos? And yet it turns out that the more central planning you have, the more chaos you have. And the less central planning you have, the more order you have. That's counterintuitive. That aspect of the libertarian message is counterintuitive. But once you grasp it, once you see why it is that way, you realize again how beautiful and elegant the ideas are. And you get these ideas, that you get the explanation for what's wrong with a centrally planned economy right out of Ludwig von Mises. And he wrote that famous essay in 1920, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth. And what he was saying there is that if you have a genuinely socialist economy, not just a heavily interventionist economy where you have private property, but the government regulates it heavily and taxes heavily and redistributes heavily. That's still, in principle, a market economy. It's a mixed economy, we might say. But if you have a genuinely socialist system in which there's no private property in the means of production, and in which instead the means of production are either owned by the state or quote-unquote collectively owned or whatever, there's one entity in charge of them. If you have that system, then what follows from that? If you have that system, you have no prices for the factors of production because there's no buying and selling. If there's one owner of all the factors of production, who would be buying or selling. If you owned everything, you wouldn't buy anything, would you? You already own it. Okay, and there'd be nobody to sell it to because you're in charge of everything. And without buying and selling, the process that gives rise to the emergence of prices is stillborn. It never occurs. And so now the central planners have to figure out how to arrange this potentially infinite array of resources in such a way as best to cater to consumer preferences with the least possible waste. So let's say there's some production process that absolutely has to have steel, or it just can't work at all, and the public has heavy, heavy demand for the finished product. Okay, and then maybe there's some other production process that uses steel but could also use something else. Well, the one that urgently needs the steel and that has consumer demand backing it up can bid steel away from processes that don't need it as urgently or where their finished product is not demanded as urgently by the public. And they bid it away by being willing to pay more for it. And so prices are going to move those things into the lines of production where they have their most value productive use. Without prices, there's no way to compare. For example, if I have two processes, one involves 7 units of steel and 6 units of lumber, and another one involves 6 units of steel and 7 units of lumber, which is the more efficient? Which one is least wasteful? Because I have no common unit to compare them in, because there's no price for either of these things that would immediately tell me, all right, well, then this one is scarcer, or this one is in higher demand, or this one's more expensive, better use this or that or whatever. There's no way for me to compare these different projects, so I can't do any profit and loss calculation, so I can't tell if a particular process is doing well or is it doing poorly. Should I expand it? Should I contract it? Should I do this? Should I do that? There's no way to do that because I can't calculate profit and loss because I'm missing prices, which are the mechanism I use to calculate profit and loss. And so therefore, I am functioning completely in the dark. I'm groping around amidst trillions of production possibilities. I'm groping around with nothing to go on. And that's why the more planning there is, the more disorder there is. Because if the planning board, in effect, is overseeing state-owned property, it's trying to make decisions completely in the dark. It has no prices for the factors of production to go on. Hey, everybody, let's take just a minute to remind you that there are so many things that people can struggle with, like anxiety and depression and stress and relationship issues, and they afflict us for so long and so regularly that we come to assume that this is just part of life, that there's nothing we can do about this. This is just our fate. In fact, we're so caught in it that the very question of whether it could be avoided, whether there's anything that could be done about it, sometimes doesn't even cross our minds. Well, Woods is here to tell you that there is help in the form of our sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp will figure out exactly what it is you need, match you up with a licensed professional therapist who specializes in what you need. It's convenient, professional, and affordable. You can check out the ton of testimonials on their website. And by the way, just in case they don't fix you up with your perfect therapeutic match, they'll get you another one. So many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/woods. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/woods. Here's another one. There are a lot of people who think libertarians don't care about the poor. We believe in social Darwinism, and the poor will just be gradually removed from existence by the harsh realities of life, and that it would be wrong to interfere in this process because we want to build a robust human being or whatever it is. This has nothing to do with libertarianism at all, but I would say the vast majority of our critics have no idea what we think. No idea. They have a caricature in their minds, and they're going to stick to that like grim death. So, what do we believe about these sorts of things? Well, there's a lot that can be said about policies that genuinely help the poor. A lot. And of course, I've talked about capital accumulation means that we can produce more stuff. And because we're producing more stuff, competition lowers the prices of these things and increases the purchasing power of everybody's paycheck. That's the genuine mechanism by which over the past couple of hundred years, we've seen something like a 30-fold increase in the standard of living of the average person. It's because of that. It's not because of the welfare state, because we've seen this increase even in countries that are too poor to have a welfare state. And we can point to example after example of government policies that are supposedly intended to help the poor, but wind up making the situation worse for them. Whether it's a family wage or whatever it is, these things make the situation worse to the point where you almost have to think, this can't be by accident. I mean, they can't be this dumb that they keep introducing policies that actually have the effect of hurting the poor. Could they really just be really stupid? Or is it more likely that they want people to stay poor and dependent because that's how they can ensure that they get the votes? I don't know. I don't know if you're ready for that level of cynicism or not. But what I want to say about the kind of redistributive policies that have been advocated as the way to help the poor advance. Well, number one, we saw that there were consistent declines in poverty, like from 1950 up to around the late 60s when the Great Society programs really began to get serious funding. You would see a percentage point or two decline per year, every year in the poverty rate, and then it just began to stagnate after that. After government got really involved. Well, here's the issue that was identified by Charles Murray, and I also talked about this in his book, In Pursuit of Happiness and Good Government. Charles Murray says this, let's imagine the government was trying to devise a program to get people to quit smoking. First of all, you can't just say this program applies to absolutely anybody because then some people would start smoking and then quit 5 minutes later and then say, I successfully quit. This has to be for hardcore smokers, get them to quit. But we need a sufficiently great incentive to get them to quit because it's hard to quit smoking. It's an addictive behavior. It's hard to quit. So we need a strong incentive to get them to quit. So let's say, and I'm going to adjust his figure upward because he wrote his book a long time ago. Let's say we say that you get $20,000 if you quit smoking. So now you see why we can't just say the whole public is eligible for this, because then people will start smoking, they'll smoke one cigarette, they'll stop and say, give me the 20 grand. We can't do that. So let's say we'll say people who have been smoking a pack a day for 5 years, if they quit smoking, they are eligible for the $20,000. All right, so now immediately look at the incentives there. If you've been smoking for 4 years and 11 months and were contemplating quitting, well, you'd be a total chump if you quit then. You might as well smoke for an extra month and get 20 grand. So there we see that there is an incentive to persist in the behavior. How about if you've been smoking for 4 years? You think most people would continue smoking for one extra year, even if they wanted to quit in year four? You think most people would be willing to keep smoking for an extra year in exchange for $20,000? I do. So you see that there's a real problem here. The incentive has to be great enough that it will make people go to the trouble of stopping the bad behavior, but not so great that it entices people to either smoke longer or people to become smokers in the first place. So you can't make the incentive so great that it takes people who were not in that situation, not hardcore smokers, and give them an incentive to put themselves in that situation, especially when you realize that you're dealing with an addictive behavior. And so once people get into this behavior, it may be that once the 5 years pass, they can't quit because it's an addictive behavior. And so now you've drawn people into total self-destruction that they can't escape from. And now you see the analogy, of course, is with welfare payments, because getting into those programs is also a trap. That is also an addictive behavior. And it brings out some of the worst, most self-destructive behavior that then is handed down from generation to generation. And when you hear it described like that, you think, okay, yeah, actually it is more complicated than I thought. But it's way more easy just to say libertarians are heartless and they just want people to suffer. No, if I wanted people to suffer, I would continue the current system just as it is. So yes, it's true. Sometimes we take positions that on the surface seem counterintuitive. That's true. And it's tough to argue these things. That's true. And sometimes we argue things that really are very simple to understand, but it's tough to argue them because the whole world is against us. That's true too. So these ideas are beautiful and very simple at heart, but they can have their challenges in conveying them. Because number one, sometimes we're against the entire world. And number two, sometimes we're saying things that run counter to what people expect us to say. But we got to say them. Because if we're not courageous enough to say them, then we don't deserve to exist as a party. We don't deserve to be here. If we're just going to say what we think the public is ready to hear, then we might as well just give up. At the same time, I recognize not everybody is in the headspace, let's say, to hear every single thing we have to say all at once. That's true. I certainly wasn't years ago. I thought all you people were crazy. I was willing to follow you to a certain degree, but then I thought, oh, on this issue and this issue and this issue, they're all crazy. But those ideas stayed in my mind. And I reached a point eventually where I decided I had to make a decision. I had to decide either I believe in private property and the division of labor and peace. Either I believe in these things or I don't. There's no middle ground. I don't sort of believe in them. Either they are just and right and lead to good outcomes or they don't. And once I realized that, I was a goner. But thank goodness I had people who had been feeding me the unvarnished truth. Think about Ron Paul. How many times he voted alone in Congress? He was the lone no vote. He didn't just vote no on his own more than any other congressman voted no on his own. He voted no on his own, like being the sole no vote, more than all other congressmen of his time put together. Now, if the vote is 390 to 45, okay. Well, people will say, I guess there was a small minority that was against this thing. But if it's 434 to 1, there's a natural instinct to wonder about who is that one? How could there be that one person who stood up to everybody? What does that one person think? And when you are a minority, as we are, the path to victory is not trying to make yourself seem like a basically unthreatening, slightly different version of what people are getting already. You got to be willing to be that one because that arouses people's curiosity. You got to be willing to say, nobody is telling you the truth about X or Y. Or don't you find both of these explanations really dumb? Like, remember the 2008 economic downturn and the left had whatever crazy explanation. And the conservative movement, because they don't talk about the Fed, best they could come up with was, well, the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977 caused this. 1977, eh? 31 years later, it's having its effects? Are you kidding me? That was pretty much all they could come up with. It was the libertarians who said, no, there is an excluded thing here that we need to talk about. And suddenly, the Tea Party people were interested. Right-wing radio was interested. I know because I wrote a book on this and I was booked on everything because finally somebody had some kind of sensible sounding free market answer to this other than, yeah, something that Jimmy Carter passed had this effect 30 years later. And so libertarian ideas got a hearing because at a time when nobody dissented from the status quo, we dissented from the status quo. Or think about the Iraq War. I was looking this up about American media sources that had an anti-war slant. It's 3%. 3% of them had an anti-war slant. That is a golden opportunity to differentiate yourself from the other sides. We are dead set against this. And we're dead set against the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And we don't speak the way they do. We don't talk about, well, U.S. interests compel us to... We don't talk that way. That's the way lizard people talk, and we don't talk that way. U.S. interests, quote unquote, never have anything to do with John Q. Public. They never have anything to do with what's in your interest, ever. It's so easy for the elites to say right now, oh, rising prices are a small price to pay to fight against tyranny. Okay, how many Walmart cashiers feel that way? And who recruited them to go right all the wrongs of the world and see their money dissipate? They didn't volunteer for this, and yet, everybody is cheering that. Everybody. There's got to be somebody with the guts to say, we did not sign up for this. Nobody said, please raid my pocketbook when I'm barely able to make ends meet as it is. Raid my pocketbook. Nobody said that. We have tens of millions of people right now who are politically disillusioned and disoriented after what they were just put through over the past couple of years. But unfortunately, the National Party has no interest in these people because they're not fashionable, right? They don't read Friedrich Hayek the way these people pretend to. and they're not sophisticated. They're backward and they don't have all the right social views. And so they're just treated with contempt. I mean, absolutely no interest in the Canadian trucker convoy, because these truckers are not the kind of people that the stuffed shirts, the head of the party, want to go have cocktails with. So no interest in that. Lots of interest in whatever the latest left-wing fad is, but no interest in these people. Well, if we're going to have any role at all, it is to be the voice of the unheard. And these people are the unheard. The people who have had their livelihoods ruined, people who have been demonized, have become pariahs within their own families. These people, this is the marginalized group in our society. These people aren't going to have a holiday in their favor. These people aren't going to have corporate CEOs writing letters of support, supporting them. They're not going to have academics cheering them. They're not going to have every Hollywood celebrity putting whatever their logo might be in their social media avatars. That's not going to happen for them. They really are the unheard and despised and demonized. And if we don't have the courage to stand up for them, then we do not deserve to exist as a movement. I also talked a bit about the resolution coming out of the Florida Libertarian Party in favor of the secession of Florida from the United States. And I said the only debate I will hear on this is whether this is an opportune moment to call for that, that maybe this will turn people away and alienate people. I don't think that's a valid argument, but that's at least an argument. I do not accept that secession can't be talked about or is wrong from a libertarian standpoint. And there are people trying to argue with me constitutionally on this. And sorry, you're going to lose on that. I make the case pretty convincingly, I think. I think I make the case for secession from a historical and moral point of view pretty convincingly in episode 1989 of the Tom Woods Show, tomwoods.com/1989. So I won't repeat that here. But the arguments are absolutely airtight. And so I'm not interested in law school graduates telling me that that's not what they learned in law school. I know it isn't. I understand that. And that's why, as my friend Kevin Gutzman, who has a PhD in history and a law degree, so he actually knows the history, he has a PhD from the University of Virginia, says, you know, don't mix up legal training with an education, you know, and don't mix up constitutional law, quote unquote, with the actual Constitution. So yeah, I know that in law school, they told you that it's an indivisible union and they gave you the John Marshall treatment, the whole thing. But they did not teach you the other side. And the other side of the argument is much, much more convincing. And I just put up a blog post linking to Abel Upshur's book on this that you can read online. Abel Upshur, everybody has forgotten. I mentioned him in a recent episode. But in the 19th century, he wrote the definitive reply to the John Marshalls and Joseph Stories of the 19th century and defended Thomas Jefferson's compact theory of the Union, which indicates that secession is absolutely legitimate. And I know that's hard even for some people listening to this to hear, because we all pledged allegiance to one nation indivisible every day in our classrooms. But that's not an argument. Indivisible is just a word. Okay, that's just a word. That's an assertion. Okay, we're going to need a little bit more than just an assertion. We're going to need more than somebody's ex-cathedra pronouncement here. I need an argument. And the arguments are pretty strong in favor of what the Florida LP was calling for. So you can look at that blog post, by the way, at tomwoods.com/compact. And I think you'll learn a lot from reading that. So I'm all in favor of that. Because, yeah, I know. I know the New York Times is going to say that is a crazy thing to say. I know that. Okay. I understand that they're not going to like that. And CNN is going to be very unhappy with the Florida LP. I get that. But if we're not willing to have this conversation, who's going to have it? And is it not obvious with the very concept of national divorce suddenly trending? Is it not obvious that we've reached an impasse here? The central government is beyond reform. And it would be vastly better for people with such dramatically opposed worldviews simply to go their separate ways. The union is not some sacred thing or some god we need to sacrifice to. It's a utilitarian thing. But unfortunately, it's taken on this sort of weirdly and disturbingly sacred quality in the minds of people. It's just a practical arrangement. And if it doesn't work, then you try something else. And yeah, we need to talk about this. Because in their hearts, a lot of people know this is true. lot of people know that 20 years from now, we're not going to be more at peace with each other. Who thinks that? Who honestly thinks that 20 years from now, political discourse will be more ironic in the United States? I don't see how that's possible. So we all know it's going to get worse, but we're not supposed to talk about this because it's not fashionable. I don't want to be part of something like that. Anyway, that's the gist of what I had to say. And this week, I'm going to get Dave Smith back on the show and we'll carry this conversation forward. Now, before we wrap up for today, I have something that all of us can agree on, and that's hot sauce. And there is a company that got its inspiration from me, apparently, and it's Tennessee Hot Sauce Company. So if, like me, you're a hot sauce fanatic, you got to have it with your eggs. You just have to have it. Or maybe you're just a casual hot sauce fan. Well, whichever you are, you got to check out Tennessee Hot Sauce Company. It's a new small batch quarterly hot sauce subscription. I mean, how about, imagine living in this day and age, right? Isn't this amazing? For all the crap we have to put up with, you can get hot sauce as a subscription. They source the freshest ingredients. They focus on the perfect balance of flavor and heat to elevate your dishes. And if you're a subscriber, you also get access to exclusive surprise seasonal sauces that change with each box and push the limits of creativity and spice. So, my friends, sign up now to be a founding member and access perks such as a permanent 10% discount, exclusive sauces, and regular giveaways as a thank you to their growing community. So, it's Tennessee Hot Sauce Company. So the website is TN, because that's the postal abbreviation for Tennessee. TNHotSauceCo.com. TNHotSauceCo.com. Sign up with promo code Woods to be entered into a drawing to win one of only 20 bottles crafted specifically to cater to the taste buds of old Woods himself. They sent me several bottles of sauce and said, which one of these do you like the best? And I said, I like this one. And so now they're going to make 20 bottles of that particular kind of sauce, the sauce that Woods likes, okay? You can get one of those if you head over to tnhotsauceco.com, sign up with promo code Woods, get yourself entered into that drawing. So go support a Tom Woods Show listener, tnhotsauceco.com. I'll link to that website at tomwoods.com/2079. And remember, you can get a nice promo for a website you're thinking of creating, but before you create it, check out my deal at tomwoods.com/publicity as to how I can help you. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.